Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Remember Venn diagrams from high school math? Well, let's say you drew a Venn diagram of the New York music scene, and you had the rock music world in one circle and the downtown avant-garde in the other. In that little place where they overlap, you would find Sonic Youth. Now, that groundbreaking band is not active these days, but all of its members are. Guitarist and singer, and occasional composer, Thurston Moore, has a new album and a new band that includes fellow Sonic Youth member Steve Shelley on drums. They'll play live for us later on the show. Now let's draw another Venn diagram. This one has just two circles. One is opera, the other is politics. And where these circles overlap, you'll find this. That's from The Death of Klinghoffer, the opera by John Adams. I'm not sure how well you can pick out the words. The line goes, "Is not their desert a garden of the Lord?" It's a beautiful melody, but it's an important line, too, because the ongoing, seemingly intractable conflict between Israeli Jews and Palestinians isn't about some patch of desert in Western Asia. It's about home. And like it or not, both sides consider that desert home. And in some circles, that idea is not welcome. And this week's opening of this opera at the Met has drawn heavy protests. We'll get the latest. Okay, one final Venn diagram. In one circle, a favorite children's movie from 40 years ago, and in the other circle, an eccentric, inventive, even twisted group of American rockers. The movie is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and its 1971 original score is full of classic and oh-so-memorable songs. The Candyman, of course.
The Candyman can. The Candyman can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
I've Got a Golden Ticket.
'Cause I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden chance to make my way.
And my favorite, the Oompa Loompa song.
Oompa Loompa Loompa-dee-doo, I've got a perfect puzzle for you. Oompa Loompa.
All of them are reinterpreted by the band Primus on their new album, Primus and the Chocolate Factory. The band will be joining Soundcheck in the Green Space for a special Halloween pre-party and live show on October 30th. And yes, Wonka-themed costumes are highly encouraged. You can find more information about the show at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. But anyway, back to the original 1971 film soundtrack. It was written by the songwriting duo of Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley. And perhaps no song from that movie has taken on more of a life of its own than this one, Pure Imagination.
There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free
if you truly wish to be.
As it turns out, since its inception in the early 70s, this song has been covered hundreds of times and has shown up in some pretty interesting places over the years. Entertainment reporter Gary Burton is back with us on Soundcheck to talk about the song. Hi, Gary.
Hi, John.
So is it fair to say, I mean, Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley, they are, if there's a great British songbook, a corollary to the great American songbook, these guys would be in it, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, yes. Apart from the songs from Willy Wonka, including the Candyman, as you mentioned before, they were also responsible for Feeling Good and also the theme to Goldfinger, amongst others. So, yeah, it's a great teaming. And this song in particular is just a great balance of music. Very strange kind of off-kilter music. And also those fabulous, very minimal, very economical lyrics.
Yeah. And so how has it become, I mean, has it become in Britain a kind of standard? I mean, we saw it in the London Olympics, right?
Absolutely, yes. Russell Brand's version of it, and I use the word very lightly.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
I think that was one of the strangest ones. I think he actually segued into I Am the Walrus as well. But, you know, everybody was celebrating the closing of the Olympics. But and the guy can sing a little bit, as he's demonstrated in a couple of movies. But, yes, it's part of the culture, as indeed it is here. And as you said, it's spawned many interesting and varied cover versions. And I think part of the appeal is that it's a bit like one of those songs. It's a bit like something like Over the Rainbow or Little April Showers in Bambi. It's, you can't really separate it from... Even if you hear a different version of it, you can't really separate it from the movie and from that particular scene. If you saw the scene with the sound off, you'd think of the song and the other way around, I think, too.
Well, but sort of paradoxically, that seems like it would kind of intimidate musicians who wanted to cover it, because you are, in fact, divorcing it from the film, from the scene in the movie, and yet it has intimidated no one.
Right. The other thing you would think might intimidate them as well from a musical standpoint is if you actually look at the sheet music for the song, the chords are amazing. The chords are like jazz chords. They're just some really, really strange, you know, E minor, 11ths over A's, that kind of thing. So I would imagine it's pretty daunting for a song, and I think perhaps that's one of the reasons why so many people in the jazz world have made a cover version of it, because it lends itself to that kind of theme.
Now, you've picked a couple of versions that come from the jazz world. The great Jamaican-born pianist Monty Alexander, for
example. Yes, yes.
Now, his version has no words. It's instrumental. So we're really focusing in on those
on
kind of...
There. Yeah.
And those
that
interesting harmonies. Listen to this. Alexander and a jazz piano trio version of the song Pure Imagination from the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Entertainment reporter Gary Burton with us on Soundcheck talking about this now standard song, which has been covered in so many surprising ways, and talking about the chord structure, these unusual kind of tall chords or stacked chords, as some people call them. That's kind of bread and butter to someone like Jamie Cullum.
Absolutely, yes. The thing that the structure allows him to do in his version is play around with that top line melody a little bit more, as a lot of jazz singers are wont to do. And it's one of the, if you actually go to a YouTube version of it and look at some of the comments, there's a lot of people saying, "I don't understand this. I don't. Why is he playing around? It's not what I know." But you know that's his job, is to explore the avenues with it.
And while Jamie is a songwriter himself, when he does cover, I mean, his cover of If I Ruled the World is astonishing.
Yeah.
It's a revelation.
He's like the old-style interpreters, like a Frank Sinatra. He can really take a song and make it his own, which is one of the real fine arts of doing a cover version.
Yeah. This is Jamie Cullum, the English pianist and songwriter and arranger, and his version of Pure Imagination.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. What you'll find when you look into your imagination will begin with a spit, traveling in the world of my creation, living there, you will see what you truly wish to be.
Jamie Cullum, the English singer, songwriter, pianist, arranger, and his version of Pure Imagination, written by the British songwriting team of Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley for the film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And Gary, you know, the opening of the song, the kind of tinkly sound in the original, has led a lot of people, you know, down very different paths. I mean, the opening sort of is your way of stamping what kind of version you're doing, it seems.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because that, it's very cleverly done, very deftly done, but it is a kind of counter melody to that. That's why it always feels slightly off kilter. It also feels like it's a waltz when you kind of remember it in your mind, but it's not.
Yeah.
And then also, I think it adds to that thing that it's a lullaby. It's drawing those kids and their family into that magical room. But there's also something just a tiny bit sinister behind it. I think it's that whole, you know, the Candyman thing and the whole, you know, don't take candies from strangers.
Right.
It's kind of that thing underneath it, even though it's just this beautiful song. You know, there's something else going off there.
Oh, well, I'm glad you used the word sinister, because that is a really good word for Fiona Apple's version of Pure Imagination. And you were talking about the lyrics before. When she delivers the line, "Want to change the world? There's nothing to it." Mm-hmm. You know, in the original, it's like, "You want to change the world? Nothing to it." When she delivers it, it's like, "You want to change the world? There's nothing to it. There's not. Why would you bother? There's nothing to it.
Right.
It's so desolate."
Yes.
And she hasn't changed a word.
No, and the interesting thing, that was part of a commercial, which was, I presume, would be trying to sell, you know, a nice, lovely, romantic feeling. But as you said, when you hear the song isolated, it does, again, take under that slightly kind of sinister feel.
So this was done for one of those big, like, 3-minute long commercials for Chipotle.
Yeah, it was a kind of a viral commercial, I guess. And it is actually worth looking at because it's a really, really lovely animation. And the song is one of the, I think, probably the best cover version that I've heard, certainly.
I would agree. Here's a little bit of Fiona Apple's Pure Imagination.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with the spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. Maybe want a view paradise. Simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world. There's nothing to it.
Fiona Apple and her version of the song Pure Imagination, done for a very strange commercial for Chipotle, an online commercial about factory farming and stuff like that.
Right, yeah. Somehow it lends itself. I don't know particularly why it does. The song's also been used, I think, fairly recently in an AT&T commercial with either the original or a close facsimile of the original. So, and it's cropped up several times. And also, of course, that scene has been spoofed many times. There's the great one in Family Guy where it's pure inebriation, which is fantastic.
Take a drink and you'll sink to a state of pure inebriation. You'll be tanked like the whole Irish nation. When you drink enough of my beer, you will find this magic rule. Make your every joke a jewel. You'll drive drunker than Oksana Bayul.
That is all kinds of wrong.
Really is, yes.
I mean, it doesn't even make sense, half of it.
Kind
of
doesn't. No, it's fun, though. Fun.
All right, so from Family Guy, Pure Inebriation is there. Reworking of Pure Imagination from the film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And we are revisiting the song because Primus is revisiting the song with their new album Primus and the Chocolate Factory. And again, joining us on October 30th for a kind of pre-Halloween party and live performance downstairs in the green space. It's happening at 1 p.m. on October 30th. And we're asking you to come in a Willy Wonka-inspired costume. Gary Burton, so there are as many covers as we've already tried to cram in. There are many, many orders of magnitude more out there. Maroon 5 did one for an Obama campaign.
It's actually not too bad. I think everybody wants to immediately say Maroon 5, huh? But it's actually okay. It's pretty decent.
Well, you're a bit more generous towards it than I would be. The cast of Glee.
Yes.
But one that I want to end with is Lou Rawls. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this is not so many years after the movie came out. This is 1976. So he doesn't have the benefit of, you know, a lot of time having passed. There's no irony here. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. As you say, it's so close to the original. I mean, I guess they just must have fallen in love with the song, and you know, like we all did when we first heard it. You know, maybe because he has that strain of that jazz thing as well we talked about before coming through and can play around with it. The great thing about the Lou Rawls version is it's a kind of light disco version, as would be for that kind of era. But, of course, he does the spoken intro at the beginning, and because it's Lou Rawls, he has that voice. So that's one of the reasons why it's so compelling, I think.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Now count to three. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
Gary Burton, thanks so much. Good to see you again.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Traveling in the world of my creation, what we'll see will defy explanation.
Up next, we'll be joined by Thurston Moore right here in our studio. The Sonic Youth co-founder has a new solo album out, and we'll hear some of it live next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. After the announcement of Sonic Youth's indefinite hiatus back in 2011, we weren't sure what would come next from the band's co-founder, Thurston Moore. Around the time of that announcement, he released a Beck-produced solo album called Demolished Thoughts, but that introspective acoustic release was followed up by a new noise rock project called Chelsea Light Moving. So what would come next? Well, a move to London and a new record, as you're about to hear. Thurston Moore and some of his all-new band will be playing songs for us today from the new album called The Best Day. This first one's called Speak to the Wild. Here's Thurston Moore and company live on Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thank you.
The song's called Speak to the Wild, live performance from Thurston Moore from his new album called The Best Day. You heard Thurston Moore singing and playing guitar, James Sedwards playing guitar, and Steve Shelley behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Not with us today is the bass player Deb Googe, on loan from My Bloody Valentine. Thurston Moore, good to have you back.
Thanks, John.
So, Sonic Youth, and you, as a solo artist, very much kind of associated with New York, and now here you are in London. What occasioned the move?
Oh, I relocated to London because I felt like I needed, in my mid-50s, I was looking for some kind of radical relocation experience. And
was it radical?
Yeah, I mean, moving to London has been really completely wonderful for me. It was really welcoming there. I have friends there, and mm-hmm. I had been going back and forth quite a bit, I decided that I wanted to spend more time there.
Mm-hmm. Was any of this album written there?
It was entirely written there. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel any difference in the songwriting process? Does place affect creativity?
Place certainly affects the emotional state of songwriting. I wouldn't deny that, and I mean, I always thought New York was very defining for Sonic Youth. Even though Sonic Youth early on made a point of getting out of town.
Sure.
I remember we started touring immediately. And, when we started in 80, 81, Lee already had some experience touring with Glenn Branca.
Right. That's Lee Ranaldo. Yeah.
Yeah. And Lee Ranaldo. And we just, we rented a van mm-hmm. and we left town. And not too many people were doing that. I mean, bands like us weren't really doing that so much unless you had a booking agent. But booking agents were kind of a luxury that we did not have. And only a few bands did. I remember bands like Bush Tetras, mm-hmm. who were like at that time were the greatest band in New York at that time was Bush Tetras. They were wonderful. And they were like touring. And I always thought that was really exotic. And Lydia and Eight Eyed Spy had gone out and done stuff. So there was this, I knew that it could be done. So we just did it and played in front of eight people like in mm-hmm. Raleigh, North Carolina and things like this. The eight people I still see. They still come up to me and go like, wow, that was like, this radical thing for them.
Have you counted the eight people as they were? Is it like 750 people? I was one of those eight people that was there.
It was eight max, let me tell you that much. Yeah. There was a couple of shows where there was pretty much the bartender and his
There were so, I'm sure you've heard the story of the Sex Pistols show in England where only 50 people showed up mm-hmm. and all 50 went off and formed bands. So
exactly.
That we hear those kind of stories, those creation myths all the time.
One person is Jeb Bishop, the trombonist, new music, free improvising trombonist, lives in Chicago and plays a lot with the Chicago improvising scene. A wonderful musician. But he was there. He was one of the eight people.
He was one of the... Yeah. Okay. We're speaking with Thurston Moore. His new album is called The Best Day, and it is... it's in the Sonic Youth mold in that you have two guitars, bass, and drums.
And Steve Shelley.
And Steve Shelley on the drums. And people will naturally hear echoes of Sonic Youth. You've got these two sprawling guitar-based pieces that kick off the album. You Speak to the Wild and Forevermore. But they also kind of take me back to television, Marquee Moon, this kind of long form.
Well, that's a completely significant group for me. And I don't have any intention of ever replicating Sonic Youth. I mean, Sonic Youth is so life defining for me. Mm-hmm. Sonic Life is tattooed to my arm from 1982. I mean, it's not something, it's a really sort of, it's probably the biggest part of my professional and emotional life is Sonic Youth. I mean, it's a really sacred thing. And I don't have any intention of trying to replicate that experience. Mm-hmm. And what it is experience. I mean, you can't just put like 30 years on the table and say, go for it. I mean, that's something that was of its time. And we developed as a group. It was a democratic thing. And I'm not really interested in that. I'm not interested in trying to create something that will, for the next 30 years, we're going to really sort of create something. Right now, it's all about being in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I would never want to disrespect the legacy of Sonic Youth by saying like, "Oh, this is the new Sonic Youth" or something, because it certainly is not.
Right.
Interplay between me and Lee is so singular, and, mm-hmm. That I would never ever want to even try to get involved with that. And all of those four players, myself included. I mean, it's just it's not something that I feel like I need to replicate because it's we did so much work.
Yes, yeah, 30 years, many albums.
And I feel like so
tours.
Many people have certain parts of it that they know of. Very few people know like all of our catalog besides us. You know, I know there's people who have little favorite parts of us.
Right.
And I think in a way it's nice to have this kind of period of rest for anybody to want to go back and maybe do a little analytical study of what we did.
Well, I thought that's what was so intriguing was that as I was hearing these pieces, I wasn't thinking so much Sonic Youth as I was television. Or do you know The Wedding Present, this English?
I do, yes.
Yeah. I mean, these just like reveling in the sound of the guitars and stuff like that. The album's called The Best Day. And let me ask you about the cover. It's this really striking black and white photo. It's your mom, right?
Yes, it's my mom. It's my mom when she was like early 20s, if not 20, and in the 40s, embracing her dog in a lake and gazing at the camera, and both of them. And I believe the photo was taken by my father, who she was courting at that point. And right when I saw the photograph, I knew that it was the image I wanted on the cover. I had different ideas going on, and things that were a bit more sort of charged and possibly subversive. And I, but this seemed like a good statement to make, and it felt like I was sort of expressing something that obviously was in a state of grace, you know, and it had a sense of feeling of goodness and serenity and safety, and I liked that, and I thought that was a good thing to sort of just put out there as opposed to anything else.
And so The Best Day became the title of the album. Wasn't it originally supposed to be Detonation?
Yeah. I mean, there's a song on there called Detonation. It's a song about being in London, specifically Stoke Newington, and what the history of that we knew about in Stoke Newington that seemed to be disappearing. And it was a lot about that was a hotbed of sort of radical activity in the early 70s there. And there was some interesting people who lived there who were called the Stoke Newington Eight, who were a bit of an adjunct of the Angry Brigade, and they were primarily anti-Vietnam War and the imbalance of power.
So you did some history. You did some homework.
I kind of knew about this stuff, but I mean, my interest in that those lifestyles of people who devote themselves to the welfare of the disenfranchised. And in England, it seems to be it has a lot to do with anarchist ideals. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was fascinated by it.
Well,
that's what this song is about.
Let's hear it. Okay. It's called Detonation. Thurston Moore and James Edwards playing the guitars. Steve Shelley behind the drum kit. Thurston Moore's new album is called The Best Day. And this song is on it. This is a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio called Detonation.
Thank you. toy grenade.
The song is called Detonation, live performance from Thurston Moore here in the Soundcheck studio with James Edwards on guitar and Steve Shelley behind the drum kit. And Thurston Moore's new album called The Best Day. Thurston, in the wake of, you know, the announcement of the indefinite hiatus of Sonic Youth and your breakup with Kim Gordon, I think people were expecting a kind of a Shoot Out the Lights style breakup album. This is not that album, is it?
I suppose not, no.
In fact, it seems
The original title of the record was Divorce, Divorce, Divorce. But I changed it at the last minute. I would never. I just don't feel like making a record like that, so, yeah.
Well, also, your lyrics tend to be a little more cryptic, a little more oblique, and not
I suppose
quite...
so. I mean, when I write lyrics, I never really write them with the state of intention to actually sort of describe something or analyze something, or I usually sort of use just the practice of writing poetry, because mm-hmm. which I'm very involved with, and there's certain ways of approaching writing poetry. Again, it's like what we were talking earlier about music. It's like there's a certain school, there's a certain lineage of how poetry has been written in the 20th century, and how that's evolved, and the different sort of shared ideas that come into play. And there's a lot of academic ideas, and there's a lot of sort of wild style ideas, and there's lots of hybrids of that. But for me, it's all about meter and rhythm and lines on the paper and the visual aspects of it, and like how that works as a piece, mm-hmm. As a creative piece of writing, as a poem. And so when I write with, first of all, primarily with that in mind, of creating a piece like that, and having the practice of writing sort of be the reflection of possibly what's going on, whatever emotional state might be there. And that's where the magic is. And that's where the magic is in music. It's just like taking the guitar out of the case and putting it on and starting to play. And I like to sort of take rest of moments between playing. And I know there's this idea of, like, you write every day, you play every day. I mean, that's where you keep up your practice. And I respect that and understand that. But I do also like this other idea of, like, locking it away a little bit and meditating and contemplating it on it to some degree, or letting life sort of have its muse and then coming back to it. And it comes out in a really interesting way. And, I mean, personally, that's just how I work. So
Thurston Moore, longtime central figure on the New York music scene, now based in Stoke Newington in North London, which is where the new album was written. It's called The Best Day. Thurston, it's been great seeing you again. And
yeah, I mean, I'm New York is really where I'm from.
Yeah.
And when I come here, I come home, So it's just like, it's not like I'm abandoning New York City.
Good, glad to hear.
Sonic Youth since the early 80s has traveled around the world so many times that I felt like we were part of the world's landscape. But coming to New York was always coming home. And I still feel that way, even though I don't have keys to a place here right now. I still feel that way.
You're welcome here anytime. You have a song to play us out with?
Yes. It's a song called Grace Lake, which was the pseudonym of Anna Mendelssohn, who was a wonderful poet who's no longer with us, who was actually a member of the Stoke Newington Eight. And we would like to play this. It's an instrumental, so.
Okay. The new album's called The Best Day. Once again, James Edwards on guitar, Steve Shelley behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio, and Thurston Moore on guitar in this live performance of a piece called Grace Lake.
Thank you.
That's Thurston Moore and his band with their song Grace Lake from his new album, The Best Day. You can hear more of our session with Thurston Moore, a lot more, and check out photos from his visit to our studio on our website, soundcheck.org. Coming up next, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Metropolitan Opera's Lincoln Center home earlier this week as the company performed a controversial opera for the first time. We'll find out why all the protesting next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Death of Klinghoffer is an opera written by John Adams back in 1991. It's an operatic telling of a true story about a hijacked cruise ship off the coast of Egypt in the 1980s. Since its creation over 20 years ago, the opera has often ignited controversy, and the latest production of The Death of Klinghoffer is no exception. This week, the Metropolitan Opera here in New York performed The Death of Klinghoffer for the first time, and it caused quite an uproar. Joining me now by phone from the New York Times is reporter Michael Cooper, who's been covering this controversy for the Times. Michael, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So the Met Opera, it's their first ever performance of The Death of Klinghoffer earlier this week, although the piece has been played here in New York before. What happened at opening night?
It was a pretty wild night at the opera. You had several hundred protesters in the traffic island across the street from Lincoln Center, joined by a number of former and current elected officials, including, you know, Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor, David Paterson, the former governor. And it was, you know, quite an impassioned, you know, angry protest. You had other protesters sitting in wheelchairs they had rented for the occasion, lining Columbus Avenue. There were police barricades set up all in front of Lincoln Center, so ticket holders had to sort of walk a maze of barricades to get to the front door. And then once they got there, security was incredibly tight. You had uniformed police officers and plainclothes police officers at the Met. Bag searches are routine at the Met, but this time they were really looking, and everybody had to check their bags downstairs in the coat check, which is unusual. So it was really quite a scene at the opera.
Now, you mentioned the wheelchairs. That's because the opera deals with the murder of a wheelchair-bound Jewish passenger named Leon Klinghoffer during the 1985 hijacking of the Achille Lauro, the cruise ship, which was hijacked by Palestinian terrorists. And so that is the subject matter of this opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. And how did the actual, when you were in the opera house, how did the performance come off? Were there interruptions?
There were a few, and the protesters had been hinting that they might try to disrupt the opera in various ways. And I think, you know, the performers and the staff at the Met were prepared for all kinds of eventualities. In fact, what happened, it began a little bit late because the security made it hard for people to take their seats on time. There were scattered boos and then some incredibly loud cheers when the conductor, David Robertson, you know, took the podium. The opera began. At first, it seemed pretty much like a normal night at the opera. The opening scene is a chorus of exiled Palestinians. As it ended, there were a few isolated boos and a few, you know, a bit of applause, but nothing much. There was one major disruption, I would say, during the first half of the opera before the intermission, when a man in the balcony stood up and shouted, "The murder of Klinghoffer will never be forgiven," repeating it several times. I noticed this morning the classical music critic in the Washington Post, Anne Majette, thought his repetition sounded a little bit like the minimalist music that inspired Adams, but he was ushered out and later arrested, the Met said, on disorderly conduct charges. And then during the second half, there were very few interruptions, although at one point a woman sitting behind me in the orchestra stood up and cried out, "This is a piece of excrement." That's not the word she used. Mm-hmm. And ushers and came, and she said, I'm going, and she left as well, and she was not arrested. So those were the only two real interruptions. There were some scattered boos at the end, although there was also a standing ovation and really a roar of cheers for when John Adams took the stage at the end of the night. So it was a very intense night at the opera.
Well, this is, you know, this wouldn't be surprising, I guess, if it were, you know, a brand new opera, or if we were talking about, you know, 20 years ago when these events were still recent. Why is this opera controversial now when, you know, it's a 1991 opera?
Well, the opera certainly stirred some controversy in 1991. I mean,
if
you recall, it premiered in Brussels, but some of the houses that you know, helped, you know, pay for the co-production, it never somehow reached their stages. There were some criticisms when it came to BAM in 1991. You know, critics didn't like it. But since then, it's been performed more regularly in recent years without major mishap, or you know, it was performed at Juilliard in 2009 in New York. It was performed in 2011, I think it was, in St. Louis. However, once it came to New York, it touched a raw nerve, perhaps because this is the city where Leon Klinghoffer lived. It's a city with a large Jewish community. It came at a time when many Jews were upset about the alarming anti-Semitic incidents in Europe, the reactions to the war in Gaza. And what I think really spurred this to some extent, I mean, it's a bit of a chicken and egg question, but last June, a bunch of Jewish groups began pressuring the Met. Some of them wanted them to cancel the production altogether. In the end, a compromise was reached with the Anti-Defamation League. The Met agreed that it had originally planned to simulcast this opera to movie theaters around the world November 15th as part of its Live in HD program. The Met said that it would sort of bow to the pressure from Jewish groups and cancel the simulcast, go on with the opera, and they would include a note from the daughters of Leon Klinghoffer, Lisa and Ilse Klinghoffer, who have never liked this opera, in the programs, which they did. Mm-hmm. That was a compromise that maybe it satisfied almost nobody, because some people thought that the Met was caving into pressure and, you know, were upset that it struck a blow against artistic freedom. Others asked, you know, if this opera is problematic abroad, why is it okay to see at home? And so I think in some ways, while they had hoped this compromise would tamp down passions, I think it may have inflamed them.
Well, we're speaking with Michael Cooper, reporter covering classical music and dance for the New York Times, about John Adams' opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, which is currently being performed at the Metropolitan Opera. There's another performance on Friday night, and it runs through Saturday the 15th. And as Michael tells us, it can be seen on stage, but not through the Met's pretty successful HD program in movie theaters around the country and around the world. The protesters do not present a unified front here. You quote Mayor Giuliani, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, as saying that he's not asking that the Metropolitan Opera, you know, delete the work from the repertoire. He wants to just, you know, he's saying they have a right to present the work and we have a right to sort of protest the historical inaccuracy within it. That's different from a lot of the other people who are protesting and saying this supports terrorism, you know, it's supporting murder, and, you know, the language seems to be going in several different directions at once.
Right. Former Mayor Giuliani took a very moderate approach in his condemnation of the opera and also made it clear that he had listened to it and read the libretto. Many of the protesters have not, and they were likening it to Nazi propaganda. They were calling for the Met to cancel it. You know, one protester, there was a second protest was held on the opening night of the Met season in September. They were playing The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart inside, but there was a loud, angry anti-Klinghoffer protest outside. And the master of ceremonies, you know, said that the protesters would be there every night of the Klinghoffer opera until the set is burned to the ground. Peter Gelb, the general manager of the Met, said that he had received threats related to the production. There were members of the cast who had internet harassment. So there was a segment of protesters who were very impassioned and really tried to kind of intimidate the Met into canceling the production.
And does the Met plan to continue the kind of beefed up security that we saw on opening night of the run?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, Mr. Gelb said last night that they had been, you know, prepared for worse interruptions than they received. I don't know if they'll take that to mean, you know, mission accomplished, we can go on, or if they'll, you know, keep a heavy police presence there just in case.
Well, you had mentioned earlier the chorus of exiled Palestinians in this opera. There's also a chorus of exiled Jews. There's a dawn chorus. There's a dusk chorus. There's a day, you know, day and night, ocean and desert. So it seems this is a work about balance, but the protesters are seeing balance as a way of equating good with evil. Is that basically what you were seeing out on the street across from Lincoln Center Plaza?
That was one of the critiques that was leveled against it, that, you know, and people felt that it created a false balance or a moral equivalency, but by putting these, juxtaposing these two things, you were saying that people have an equal right to their points of view. There was another school of thought that said that the opera has, you know, the hijackers sing of their grievances and they sing, you know, in a humanizing way. Some saw that as justifying their or legitimizing their actions, which I think the production, which was much more literal than many of the past productions, which tended to be more abstract. Mm-hmm. I think it tried to underscore in many cases that, you know, they made it clear that the hijackers were bad guys. They were constantly brandishing guns and, you know, menacing people on stage. It was it was interesting to see the directorial approach that they took here with this opera that's been such a contentious lightning rod over the years.
The opera is The Death of Klinghoffer by John Adams, with libretto by Alice Goodman, and the original production was by Peter Sellers, but the current one at the Met is by Tom Morris. And as I say, it runs through Saturday, November 15th at the Met. There's a performance. The next performance is on Friday night. And we've been speaking with Michael Cooper, reporter covering classical music and dance for The New York Times. Michael, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
In these waters, nobody stirs a limb. Passengers, servants, and sailors, all the men come. There is a bomb in the engine room. If you are betrayed, the ship will explode, and you will be dead. Make this understood, and nothing will happen.
Tomorrow on the show, we talk with filmmaker Alex Gibney about his new documentary called Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown. Plus, have you heard of DJ Mustard? Yeah, neither had we. But in the past few years, the producer and songwriter has scored tons of rap and top 40 hits, with artists ranging from Ty Dolla $ign to Drake to Schoolboy Q. In another edition of our How to Be Smarter series, we'll focus on DJ Mustard. Plus, live music from the Budos Band, a motley crew of Staten Islanders who will bring their high-energy blend of Afro-soul, psychedelia, and metal to our studio. That does it for today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.